I always tell my students that there is a Shakespeare quotation for every occasion. So before I really get to the lecture tonight, let me begin with the Shakespeare quotation for this occasion. This comes from Act 3, Scene 4 of Lear. It's Edgar out on the heath talking, who says, "Through the sharp hawthorn blows the cold wind. Go to thy cold bed and warm thee." So I'll start out with a thank you for the warm welcome you've shown me. That is, of course, by way of a joke. You know, on the East Coast, I'm notorious because when the winter finally comes out there, and we have a piddly little winter that doesn't really count, occasional snow and occasionally some cold. But when the cold air comes, I'm always at my happiest, and I tell people it's my Norwegian blood leaping up. And of course, I was raised not far from here, and I say it, people don't believe me, but I miss the winters. It's just, I find this invigorating, but then I carry my own warmth with me in a sense. So I'm well protected. It's a delight to be back again, as always. It's most generous of His Excellency to keep inviting me to return. And I was thinking, because the last time I was here, I came during the season of Lent and spoke about one of the comedies, which might have seemed at the time inappropriate, and I tried to make the case that in a way it wasn't. And now, on the eve of this great feast, this great and joyous feast, I'm here to talk about one of Shakespeare's darkest tragedies. And I don't think this is in any way necessarily inappropriate scheduling, because when you're dealing with great truths, there is always something appropriate to be taken from it. And there are certainly lessons, I think, to be taken from this play, specifically relating to the notion of sainthood and what constitutes sanctity. And I'll try to get to that in the course of the lecture. What I'm going to do tonight, I'm lucky enough to have two opportunities to speak to you, and you're unfortunate enough to have to listen to me at only once, but if a few stragglers come back tomorrow night, I'll tell you what you can expect tomorrow night. I'm going to try to give an overview of the play tonight, some sense of my idea of what's going on in this play and the way it is shaped, because it is, after all, an action. Aristotle defines tragedy as the imitation of an action that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And in that sense, we have that in this tragedy. It is imitating an action. There's an action that takes place. We begin somewhere, we go somewhere, we end somewhere. And that may seem foolish in one regard, but it's extremely important in that much modern literature is circular in nature. We end up back where we began, because the modern world denies linearity. That is, a world that the actual world that we do live in, created by God, which had a beginning, exists in time, and that world at some point will end. In denying the Christian faith, they deny linearity. Shakespeare writes plays that are indeed filled with action and structured as actions. According to the Aristotelian definition, and as a result, that pattern of action tells us something. What happens to the characters over time as they exist in a real world tells us something, and that's what I'm going to try to get at tonight. And then tomorrow night, I will have the luxury to take some of the scenes and look at them in more depth, and particularly, something that I'm going to neglect a bit tonight, talk about the magnificence of the poetry. This is some of the greatest writing, not just in the English language, but some of the greatest writing anyone ever did at any time. The text of Lear is simply astounding. So tomorrow night I'll be able to go into more depth on some of the points and look more closely at some of the specific passages and specific speeches. Let me begin with a little disclaimer. Perhaps it would be appropriate to say a little secular confession here. And the reason for this is, I always have to admit this when I teach this play to my students. King Lear is my favorite piece of literature. I think it is the most astounding creation of the mind of man. I can't imagine how the man wrote it. We have it. It exists here. As a result, I can't be completely objective about it. There's going to be some subjectivism creeping into this talk, and I thought I should probably warn you about that, simply because I love the play in the way some people would love a very dear friend. And the play has been my constant companion for so long. I teach it every semester, and I've done so for many, many years. So you're not getting a completely objective view here, okay? There is some subjectivism you're going to hear. So that's by way of warning. What is tragedy? I gave a little definition when I came and talked about Macbeth. Many of you weren't here. So let me begin with the definition of tragedy, because I think it's important to have that basic understanding before we look at the play. All drama of whatever kind that is effective drama deals with conflict. It's what defines drama as a separate genre in and of itself. It is a patterning of action, as I said earlier, but it is a patterning of action in which there are severe conflicts. In comedy, the conflicts are almost always social in nature. And it is usually some sort of tension between the wishes, the desires, the will of an individual and the more generalized vision of a society at large. What's good for the greatest number of people? And obviously, there will be tensions there, and there always have been. And comedy looks at those tensions and reassures us that compromise is possible without losing any of those things that allow an individual to feel some sense of fulfillment in the world, and allows the society at the same time to continue to exist and operate as a constructive unit that is doing that which is best for the greatest number of people. As a result, comedies end quite naturally in marriage. The place where the individual, in one sense, through this great sacrament given by God, finds the opportunity for a very special kind of joy. It is not accidental that our Lord performed his first miracle at a wedding. It is a very special kind of personal joy, but it's also the way in which society ensures its continuation. It is the way in which there can be regeneration, renewal, and the social order can continue, and a social order that sets limits, that defines itself, that demands that individual desire be sanctioned, obviously on one level by God himself, but also by the society. So that the society can ensure that there are rules that the individuals follow. Tragedy is something very different. It somehow goes beyond the here and now. And the conflict in society is almost always between an individual and some large outside force. If in comedy the society and the individual can always compromise, in tragedy there can be no compromise. The individual, the tragic hero, is somehow taking on a challenge that he will lose because he is battling something that is too great. He is taking on some burden that is too heavy. He is attempting something that is beyond what is humanly possible. And in the course of the conflict, the individual, usually through his own fault and his own bad choices, will be broken and crushed. However, what makes tragedy tragedy is that in that process of being destroyed, the individual comes to greater knowledge. It is not a meaningless fall. It is not a pointless destruction. It is quite literally the rending apart of a human being. And the loss of things that we treasured, but at the same time, something important is gained. And the gain most often has to do with an understanding of great truths in the world. Therefore, as Aristotle says, at the end of a tragedy, we feel pity and fear. We feel pity in watching another human being who has gone through this dreadful process of destruction. And there is human sympathy that goes forth from us. At the same time, there is fear. Because most often, and almost of necessity, that individual is greater than we could ever be, more gifted than we could ever be, with more perceptions than we could ever have, and if that human being can fall and be crushed, what chance do we have, most of us being pipsqueaks? And hence there is that sense of fear and awe in the face of tragedy. If it can happen to the great, what about us? If such a noble figure can fall, what about us? Pity and fear. The responses, again, I'm quoting Aristotle, the responses to the tragic pattern, the tragic movement. Very simply, in most tragedies, we have tragic hero who is a great character in some way. It is essential. This greatness is essential. And that character is most often noble because there has to be a fall. There's going to be a fall. It's very difficult for someone who is of low standing or very little importance to fall. But there's also this other part of tragedy. When the hero falls, the ramifications go out and touch many other people. It is the fall of one individual, but an entire world is touched as that individual falls. You see that very clearly in Lear. Very clearly in Lear. If you think of any of the great Shakespearean tragedies, in Hamlet, it's not just the tragedy of the Prince of Denmark, it's Denmark's tragedy. The entire court is devastated. If you think of Othello, it is not just the fall of Othello. What we have is the destruction of the order that was defending Venice. In Macbeth, very clearly, the fall of Macbeth is not just the loss of a great soldier. It is the fall of a man, and the result of the fall, Scotland becomes a bloodbath. And very clearly, in Lear, King of Britain, an entire world is rent apart because of what the king does. So that the fall of one individual is not just a single story, but is rather the account of the loss and collapse of an entire world. Here in America, we have produced one great tragedy, and that is Moby Dick. And again, it's if you look there, it's a clear instance of how the tragic pattern operates. It is not just that Captain Ahab is mad. It's that Captain Ahab, in chasing the whale, has a whole crew that he brings along with him, and when Ahab goes down, everybody else quite literally goes down with him. The entire boat sinks. The crew is lost. And that's, in a way, a perfect vision of what happened in tragedy. One great man with a flaw, with some sort of serious flaw, often called the tragic flaw, who as a result of that flaw makes a tragic choice. And in Shakespearean tragedy, as in almost every tragedy that's post-Greek, there is choice, there is free will. It does not have to happen, and part of the fear we feel is watching these great figures make bad decisions, make the wrong choices. The tragedy is not necessary. It is not necessary. Nevertheless, the tragic hero makes a choice as the result of a tragic flaw, makes that tragic choice, and there is a fall. And in that fall, the entire world is rent apart, many suffer, but the hero comes to knowledge. The hero learns things that he did not know before. That's the basic pattern. Shakespeare was aware of the pattern. He had used it many times. He uses it early on in a very early play, which is a tragedy, one of the early English history plays, Richard III. Richard is a very appealing character in many ways. He is touched with hubris. He goes too far. He falls. By the end of the play, he has gained some knowledge of who he is, but it's too late. The pattern occurs over and over. He'd already written Julius Caesar. He had written Hamlet. He had written Othello. We come to Lear, and Shakespeare does something extraordinary at the beginning of this play. Quite unlike anything any dramatist had ever done before. He wrenches, if you will, the entire structure of tragedy in order to make a point. And I'm going to make the claim that he wrenches that structure in order to make a point that is a profoundly Christian point. Lear enters in the first scene of the play, and within a matter of 50 to 100 lines, has made his tragic choice. In the very first scene of the play, Lear falls. And he falls as a result of a tragic flaw, which is evident. It's pride. The king is simply so full of himself, so wrapped up in himself, so locked within his own head and his own pride that he has no notion of an outside world or what's going on around him, and as a result of that tragic flaw, makes a tragic choice. And by the tragic choice, I'm not just talking about the division of his kingdom, but rather the inability to know where genuine love and genuine loyalty exist. And he banishes love and banishes loyalty. And as a result, leaves himself unguarded. We'll look closely at that first scene. But by the time the first scene ends, the destruction is, in a sense, inevitable. The king has ripped the kingdom apart, passed it on to those who have lied to him, lied openly to him, and then banished those who genuinely love and are loyal to him. He has left himself open to his enemies. What the rest of the play is five acts of falling action. Five acts of watching the old man learn his lessons. Five acts of misery. The stripping bare of a soul. The painful recognitions of the wrongs he has done. And the slow process of coming to recognize and admit that everything that has happened has been his fault, realizing those things he did not know at the beginning, and then losing it all once again. No character, all of literature, suffers as much as Lear. And part of the pain of this play is that this man who is suffering is fourscore and upward. We are talking a man in his 80s. We are not talking about a cocky young guy who probably deserves to learn a few lessons. We are looking at age, and with age is supposed to come wisdom. And sadly, all the wisdom comes all at once as the king finds himself losing everything, and then has to witness his kingdom ripped to pieces. That would be difficult enough. I mean, that obviously, it's a remarkable way of patterning a play. But part of what gives Lear its magnificence as a drama, and the reason that most commentators view it as Shakespeare's greatest and most profound accomplishment, is that Shakespeare does something in this play he's never done before. He double plots. We don't just have the story of Lear and his daughters. He thrusts into the action a second complete action, and this is not a subplot. This is not a secondary plot, because the two actions are running side by side, and that's the story of Gloucester and his sons. So that what we have is a play with two plots, and those two plots reflect off one another, and as those two plots move simultaneously, we see the same mistake being made by another old man who should know better. And that is a man who makes a tragic choice in choosing to believe a liar against someone who is loyal, loving, and a truth teller. It is the same pattern. It is another old man. It suggests, because of the double plotting, that we are dealing with a universal principle. Not the story of one unfortunate individual, but something that is a principle by which the world seems to operate. And that principle seems to be, man will inevitably, out of his own pride and ignorance, bring about his own destruction. The vision is of fallen man. And I don't know anywhere else where it is presented as blatantly as in King Lear. Because it seems to be a principle of our nature. What is Shakespeare saying? Something that is quite, that for anyone who knows the Catholic faith, something that any Catholic should know in his heart of heart, in his mind, and simply be aware of as a theological fact, and that is, man is fallen by nature. But it is something that is easy to forget, and what the play insists on is, man is not only fallen by nature, but because of that flaw in our nature, we are capable of extraordinary wrongs. And we are able to bring about enormous quantities of destruction. And there it is, from the beginning. Not something we watch develop slowly. It's in the beginning. It's from the start. It's the defining moment. Man is fallen. I want to look just briefly at the first scene to give some sense of this and the way in which we are presented this powerfully, but almost without our being aware of it. Curiously, the play begins in prose, not with the king himself, although there's discussion of the king, and there seems to be a sense, there seems to be knowledge that the king is about to do something. It appears that he may be dividing the kingdom. It looks as if Albany and Cornwall are somehow going to be vying for the largest chunk of the kingdom. But what the first discussion in the play is really about is Edmund, the bastard. And it is Gloucester talking about his illegitimate son who is there at court with him. Kent, one of these little moments of confession. Kent is my favorite character in all Shakespeare. Just get that out of the way. I don't know of any other character in all Shakespeare that I admire as much as I admire Kent. What a remarkable man. In any case, Kent makes a quite innocuous remark, the sort of thing. Imagine, if you will, this is a state function at the White House, okay? And you have a number of dignitaries standing around just before the president comes in to make a major announcement and making small talk. And one of the advisors to the president says, is not this your son, my lord? And Gloucester, not really embarrassed, said, his breeding, sir, hath been at my charge. I've so often blushed to acknowledge him that now I am brazed to it. Kent doesn't get what he's saying. We have a little bit of political language there, a little bit of politeness, okay? A couple of little puns to obscure the meaning, and Kent says, I cannot conceive you. I don't know what you're saying. I cannot conceive you. Sir, this young fellow's mother could. Whereupon she grew round-wombed, and had indeed, sir, a son for her cradle, ere she had a husband for her bed. Do you smell a fault? And suddenly we're talking about the illegitimate birth of this child. Where does state function? Kent, I cannot wish the fallen down, the issue of being so proper. he's a fine lad, fine strapping lad. It's an extraordinary way to begin the play, but the fact of the matter is, consider what Gloucester is talking about. Openly admitting to another high official, another dignitary, and offhandedly. Oh yeah, he's my illegitimate son, he's a bastard, but I don't care anymore. I've acknowledged him so often it doesn't matter. What do we have? It is very obvious. A complete blindness to sin. We have a heart that has become so hardened by sin that he is blinded to sin. Oh, yes, I did something terribly wrong in the past. He goes on to make jokes about it. I have a son, sir, by order of law, some year elder than this, who yet is no dearer in my account. Though this knave came something saucily to the world before he was sent for, yet was his mother fair. There was good sport in his making, and the whoreson must be acknowledged. It's completely inappropriate. It's embarrassing. But it is showing us that this man is blind. And what's going to happen, sadly, in the course of the action is he will be made blind. There will be a physical manifestation of a spiritual fact. And the blindness of Gloucester at the beginning of the play will lead to his blinding later in the play. And we will meet him in Act 4, where he will have to begin to acknowledge it by saying, I stumbled when I saw. When he had his eyesight, he could not see. This is before we've even met the king. It's what I mean by the double plotting. We are already on the brink of one tragedy occurring before the king even comes in. The king enters and simply says, know that we have divided in three our kingdom. Among the first words out of his mouth. Now, the fact of the matter is, it's one of those things that's so obvious you have to underline it. What is a king supposed to do? He's supposed to rule his kingdom. And why do you have a king to rule a kingdom? So that there will be unity, so the kingdom will be one, so there will be a head authority, there will be someone who will make the decisions. So here comes the king, and the first thing the king says is, okay, I'm going to split it into three and give it away. Well, this is madness. This is madness. But it is the madness under the guise of seeming sanity at the beginning of the play, and it's not until, again, later in the play, we will see this poor old man go mad. As Gloucester is blind at the beginning and then becomes really blind, Lear is mad at the beginning and then is forced to go really mad. 'Tis the time's plague when madmen lead the blind. And this play is going to be filled with crazy people. Or people impersonating crazy people. Because the only way you can survive in the collapsed world that's going to result is you better pretend to be crazy. You got to pretend to be crazy. Now the normal people are really crazy. But if you're normal, then you better pretend to be crazy so they'll leave you alone. And by the middle of the play, everything has been turned upside down. Everything has been inverted, seemingly, except the point I'm making is, at the beginning of the play, it's already there. People are callously talking about their past sins if they don't matter. People are not doing their jobs in public, with no one seeming at first to care. And 'tis our fast intent to shake all cares and business from our age, conferring them on younger strengths, while we, unburdened, crawl toward death. And it's in those words we have to begin to have some sympathy for the old man. He's in his 80s. He's still king. He doesn't want to be king anymore. Who wants to work when they're in their 80s? I'm in my late 40s, and I'd give it up tomorrow if I could. Why? Because work is hard. Work wears you out. One sits around dreaming of retirement. And if I'm doing it now, I can just bet if I had to. If they suddenly said, you can't get your pension until you're 85, oh, here. You know, I'd think about it all the more. But by the time I got into my 80s, I'd think about it a whole lot. And what the old king is doing is he's an old king, and he's thinking about, I don't want it anymore. I don't want it anymore. Shake all cares and business from our age. Nobody wants to work. Work is hard. Work is even harder if you're in charge of everything. But of course, you can't just chuck it. You especially can't just chuck it if you're the man in charge. So while on a human level we can sympathize and understand, and this is hugely important, perhaps I'll make that division again, on the subjective level we can completely understand, objectively the king can't just say, erase, erase, I'm not king anymore. But then sadly we realize it's worse than that, because it's not just that he's about to give it all up. He's going to do it in the worst way possible, which has nothing to do with the good of the country or the good of the citizens or the good of those that he has been placed in this position to watch over. He is about to do it for a public display of personal affection. And he says to the daughters, how much do you love me? Tell me in public. Here in this state occasion with everybody present, tell me how much you love me. Now, Lear, in one sense, makes his tragic mistake on three different levels. He certainly makes it as a king. As I said, he has no right to simply give up the crown, split the kingdom in three, and say, I'm not king anymore, erase, I don't want to do it anymore, I'm tired. He certainly doesn't have the right to do it at a public ceremony based on this personal display of affection or a contest among his three daughters. So as a king, he makes a tragic mistake that will have tragic consequences for the kingdom. But he is also a father. And as a father, Lear makes a tragic decision. Lear, as father, says to his three daughters, you must love me. And because you must love me, you now have to tell me how much you love me. And he is assuming that the daughters will love him. But what he's going to find out, and it's the truth that Cordelia tells him to his face, I love your majesty according to my bond, no more nor less. It's a harsh thing, but the fact of the matter is, he is entitled to honor from his children. That's one of the commandments. Honor thy father and mother. One respects them, and she goes on to explain, good my lord, you have begot me, bred me, loved me. I return those duties back as our right fit. Obey you, love you, and most honor you. But notice the language. It's cold, it's distinct. Here, it's cool, it's distinct. Here it is. I will do my obligations. This is what I'm supposed to do. But there are certain things you cannot ask of me. Why have my sister's husbands if they say they love you all? Haply when I shall wed, that lord whose hand must take my plight shall carry half my love with him, half my care and duty. Sure, I shall never marry like my sisters to love my father all. Not what somebody who's asking for a public display wants. What does he get? A truth. And the truth can often be harsh. The truth can often be a bit cool, or seemingly so. And the fact of the matter is, Lear isn't looking for that kind of love. He is looking for a public display, and he gets it from the other two daughters. Oh, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you so much, I love you, I love you, I love you. I mean, if you look at Goneril's first speech, it's just embarrassing. Sir, I do love you more than words can wield the matter. I love you more than words can say. But she doesn't shut up then. We know she's a liar in the first instant because she says, I love you more than words can ever say. Now I'll tell you how much. Dearer than eyesight. Oh man, it's one of those moments. First time you read the play, you just pass over it. Second time through, dearer than eyesight, coming from Goneril. Every instant in this play is doing work. And that dearer than eyesight is going to come back to sting later in the play. Dearer than eyesight, space and liberty. Beyond what can be valued, rich or rare. No less than life, with grace, health, beauty, honor, as much as child e'er loved or father found. A love that makes breath poor and speech unable. Beyond all matter of so much I love you. Oh, please. And you wouldn't dare stage it this way, but obviously the old king is standing there doing what? Give me more. Yeah, good. Come on, more. Oh, I love it. I love it. And the fact of the matter is, no father would ask such a thing or expect such an overflow of phony emotion. And yet, boom, that Lear is reveling in it. Cordelia's response to herself, what shall Cordelia speak? Love and be silent. And what's the problem here? And it's a problem that's going to run throughout this play. And it's a modern problem. It's one of those moments when Shakespeare puts his finger on the pulse of what was going to become the modern world. After Goneril's speech, language has been destroyed. How can you use the word love when it has just been debased like that? What possible words can genuine love use to express that love when words have just been abused and tortured in order to create a profound phony lie in order to get a big chunk of the kingdom? There are no words left for Cordelia to use. Words can be drained of meaning when they are not properly used. When I was driving back to the academy at the end of the summer, I was flipping on I had the car radio on, just trying to find something to listen to so I wouldn't sleep at the wheel. And I was overwhelmed yet again with the number of evangelical preachers out there. Wouldn't matter what, I'd turn from what, I mean, more, as many as there are country music and hard rock stations, there are preachers out there on every radio channel. And wherever I would turn, it would, you know, God loves you. You know, you'd quick turn to another one and, you know, God loves you and I love you, send me your money. And you just keep turning and turning and turning. And there is a kind of absurdity to it until you realize that what has happened with all of this, how can you then speak of God? When he's simply become a word to be used to broadcast on the airwaves so that the cash will come flowing in, then there's a reason why when I walk into the classroom and start talking about God, my students' eyeballs roll into the back of their head. They've heard it. They're sick of it. The word's been destroyed. In the way that at the beginning of this scene, the word love is destroyed by those two sisters, by Goneril and Regan. Sir, I am made of that self-metal as my sister and prize me at her worth. In my true heart, I find she names my very deed of love, only she comes too short. And then Regan just goes on, blah, 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 blah. It's horrifying. But the old man is eating it up. Eating it up. Cordelia, then poor Cordelia, and yet not so, since I am sure my love's more ponderous than my tongue. I genuinely love the old man, but I love him with a weight that is something heavier. It's in my heart. It's not on my tongue. So when he turns to her and says, what can you say to draw a third more opulent than your sisters? Speak. She says, nothing, my lord. Because there are no words left. They're gone. Nothing, he says. Nothing. How? Nothing will come of nothing. Speak yet again. Nothing is another one of those words that rings through the play. I'll talk about this tomorrow night. Nothing rings through the play. Nothing will come of nothing. Yeah, the next five acts grow out of that nothing. I mean, something extraordinary. That all the horror that follows grows out of that nothing, which he hears as emptiness, but in fact is simple honesty, given the phony contest that's been set up. Second tragic mistake of Lear, he, as a father, doesn't understand the obligations of children to their father. She makes them very clear, but that's not what he wants to hear. And the third, of course, is simply his tragic mistake as a man. And as a man, he believes he deserves everything he has. He deserves the kingdom. He deserves the crown. He deserves all the attention. He deserves all the love. He deserves all the privileges. That being a human being means I get all of this. I get all of it. Which is why when he is sent off and he's on his own and he's got the 100 knights with him, he won't give them up because he defines himself by externals. In the same way that in this contest, he's defining himself by the words of love, the empty words of love. And in doing this, in not knowing what his obligations are as a king, what his obligations are as a father, what his obligations are as a man, he's going to lose it all. There is truth at the court. It still exists. It exists first in the daughter who loves him, but he can't see it. And then it exists in Kent, who in the midst of this finally stands up and says, good, my liege. And Lear erupts. And then Kent again tries a second time. Royal Lear, whom I have ever honored as my king, loved as my father, as my master followed, as my great patron thought on in my prayers. The bow is bent and drawn, make from the shaft. Let it fall, rather, though the fork invade the region of my heart. Be Kent unmannerly when Lear is mad. Public occasion, and suddenly we've got talk that once again might not seem appropriate for a public occasion. But there's a difference between Gloucester's talk, my past sins don't matter, and Kent's talk, which is, I got to tell the truth to this old guy. He's going nuts. He's doing crazy things here. And what do we have? We have a good servant who will stand up and tell a truth even though the master doesn't want to hear it. Now, I want to make a quick point here. At one point I thought of following this pattern all the way through the whole play, but I'm not going to. I'm just going to say it here in order to give you a sense of why this play is particularly timely. You can explore the implications of it on your own. There are frightening parallels between this play and the situation that we find our beloved Mother Church in. The fact of the matter is, we have the man of great authority, the man who is the rightful king, who seemingly, whimsically decides to throw away his authority and destroy his kingdom. That is not his intention. That is not his intention when he makes that decision. He just thinks they're going to have a nice little get-together and it'll all be fun, and then he'll take it easy, and then the world will be a lovely place. Because he is blind to what's going to happen. He doesn't understand his own situation. In the midst of this self-destruction, auto-destruction of the kingdom, we'll call it, in the midst of this auto-destruction of the kingdom by the man placed in authority to preserve the kingdom, we have two characters who love him so much and love the kingdom so much that they won't let him do it without standing up to him. And the fact of the matter is Cordelia and Kent are both disobedient. They are both disobedient to the king. A king gives them both direct orders. The direct order to Cordelia is, okay, tell me how much you love me, speak. And she won't play the game. And the direct order to Kent is simply, Kent, on my life, no more. Don't you say another word, and then out of my sight. Get out of here, and then he banishes him. You're no longer part of this kingdom. You're out of this kingdom. But of course, what he is doing is banishing the ones who genuinely love him and are really loyal to him. It is part of a pattern in the play of disobedience. But the vision of the play is of a world gone so topsy-turvy that those who are loyal are the ones who are doing the destructive work, and those who are seemingly disobedient are the ones who genuinely love and are seeking to preserve all that was good. And it is not just Cordelia and Kent in the first scene, but remember, Gloucester is given a direct order by Goneril and Cornwall and Regan that he is not to go out and find the king during the storm. It is a direct order that he's been given, and it troubles him because, again, for all of his flaws, he cannot let the king be out there in the storm. They charged me on pain of perpetual displeasure, neither to speak of him, entreat for him, or any way sustain him. That's the king. Edmund says, most savage and unnatural. He's a liar. Everything he says is a lie. He's in it for his own advancement, period. Gloucester's still blind, doesn't see. If the Duke asks for me, I am ill and gone to bed. If I die for it, as no less is threatened me, the king, my old master, must be relieved. And he is disobedient to the new rulers of the kingdom. Why? Out of love for the king and out of love for the kingdom. And it is direct disobedience. But the fact of the matter is, the old rules no longer apply because everything has been blasted apart, and we are now simply trying to hold on and save that which is good and true. There is one other example of it. And it's the moment when Gloucester's eyes are being put out. And we suddenly realize that genuine loyalty and genuine love does not just exist at the top. There are three servants who are standing by as the old man's eyes are put out.